Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Welcome to the DMZ, everyone. I want to apologize for my performance last week, Bill. I let you down. I let our viewers down. I let this whole damn team down. I did not bring my A game last week, which, now, I want to admit, my B game is still better than most people's A game. But we're back to doing morning shows, and my energy level's up. And
We're in your homes every week. We're like a part of your family. You know, you're gonna see our emotional ups and downs. I think that's the wild ride our audience expects to be on. They don't want it to be a two-dimensional cutout.
I didn't get beat up last in the comments. I was expecting some letdown, you know, from me having a subpar performance, and you know, the commenters they hung with us, so good for them. But I've done espresso shots this morning, and so I think I'm ready to rock and roll.
Now, I saw yesterday on your Twitter feed, you seem very interested in the scrap going on between Donald Trump and BuzzFeed reporter McKay Coppins, who had just done a profile of Trump. He was invited on the Trump plane from his press team, and apparently one of Trump's his PR guy was fired for agreeing to getting Trump to agree to this profile, thinking it was going to be a puff piece, and it wasn't. Just so folks know, what do you know about the background of McKay Coppins? He hasn't really been a household name. I know he's one of the main reporters at BuzzFeed, but folks might not know who he is.
Okay, so McKay Coppins is a pretty young guy. He was at I think he interned at the Daily Beast. He certainly worked at the Daily Beast when Ben Smith took over and they launched BuzzFeed Politics. I think he was one of the first hires there. And he's a young, sharp reporter. He's also a Mormon, so he wrote a lot about that during the Romney campaign. And that actually makes it interesting because, one of the allegations when Trump decided to fire back at this piece that McKay Coppins was ogling is the way to pronounce the word, women at Mar-a-Lago, which is Trump's hotel and restaurant in Palm Beach. And that really does not strike people. People are incredulous about that. I mean, I think there's ethical questions to ask about the McKay Coppins piece, which is why did it take 3 or 4 weeks for him to publish it? Did he present the notion that this was an implied off-the-record time that they were spending together? Did he burn a source? I mean, all of those things are valid questions to ask, but most people who know McKay Coppins are sort of laughing at the pushback that was published on Breitbart by Matt Boyle, that, you know, allegations coming from Donald Trump, you know, retroactively that McKay Coppins was behaving inappropriately during their time together. This is just a fun story, you know.
Now, what was in the original Trump piece that was so offensive to Trump? I mean, are there specific factual inaccuracies that they are alleging, or is it just the entire tenor of the piece?
So, first of all, if you haven't read the original BuzzFeed piece, you should do so. It's a really, really interesting and well-written piece. You know, it's a pretty long profile. Essentially, so McKay Coppins was, I think it was in New Hampshire, at a speech with Donald Trump. They were, you know, McKay had asked if he could profile Trump, and they said yes. Interestingly, the email that Coppins sent has leaked out to the Daily Caller's Betsy Rothstein, where he was bragging about how BuzzFeed Politics alone gets twice the traffic as Politico. So what happened, though, is it snowed. This was at the same time, I don't know if you remember, around the time of the Chris Christie scandal. There was a big snow on the East Coast here. And rather than, I guess, going to New York City, Trump diverted his plane to Palm Beach and put Coppins up at Mar-a-Lago, his very nice hotel resort restaurant in Palm Beach. And McKay was reporting all the stuff that was said, right? So, for example, on the drive when they left, you know, when they left the speaking venue, McKay Coppins reports that that one of Trump's, quote, yes men. And by the way, Coppins refers to them as yes men, which other, you know, one man's yes man is another man's aide or
loyal aide.
But he calls them yes men. So some of this is sort of through the prism of his injecting, you know, opinion into it. That one of the yes men, you know, Trump is sort of lamenting the fact that nobody asked him about running for governor of New York. And one of the yes men says, that's because they think you're too big. Like running for governor of New York's beneath you. And Trump's like, yeah, that's what it was. You know, this is according to Coppins reporting. And then, reportedly, according to Coppins, so there's another instance when, you know, they're like, are you sure you want to go to Palm? One of the yes men's like, are you sure you want to go to Palm Beach? It's your anniversary, saying this to Trump. And Trump's like, hey, don't worry about it, you know. So there were a lot of things like that. Now, there are some factual questions. So, for example, Coppins reports that he was the only national reporter who actually covered the speech, the initial speech. The Trump people have pushed back at that, alleging that it's not true, that there was like an LA Times reporter there, that there was AP there. As far as I can tell, Coppins was right on that account, that other people wrote about it, but they weren't actually at the speech. But in any event, you know, this raises questions, I think, about the implicit off-the-record thing. I mean, Trump probably thought that he could charm, kind of wine and dine this young, you know, sort of shy-ish reporter and get a puff piece out of it. And Coppins probably played along. And acted friendly and as if everything was going to be great, honky-dory, and then screws Trump with a great, interesting piece, which kind of shows you need a killer instinct to make it in this business. So I think it's interesting, but Trump is now fired back. He's having other people sort of try to seek revenge on Coppins and most recently this Breitbart piece.
Now, I assume this is all good traffic for BuzzFeed, but I thought BuzzFeed had a no-haters policy, that they kind of weren't into, you know, takedown pieces. I'm not saying if anyone deserves to be taken down in this world, it's Donald Trump, so I'm not mortally offended by it.
Right.
But does it somewhat wrinkle the BuzzFeed brand to be embroiled in this controversy?
Well, the problem, of course, is, and Trump's people are pushing out the notion that you can't trust McKay Coppins. So if he wants to profile your candidate, beware. So the notion is that, you know, the danger is that if you burn sources, if you are extended graciousness and someone is nice to you and you repay them by portraying them in an unflattering light and reporting on things. This reminds me a little bit of the Stanley McChrystal takedown piece in Rolling Stone, where, you know, McChrystal and some officers were sitting around drinking, you know, bullshitting and criticizing the president. And there's an implicit off the record. And if you're a reporter, you're embedded with them. I mean, you know, you and I, Bill, talk, you know, we don't always say, hey, this is off the record, you know, because it's sort of an implicit off the record. And I think that Trump probably felt.
And the things that we say, if only people knew.
Right. Yeah, it's scandalous. So it reminds me a little bit of the Hastings story. Obviously, the stakes are much, much lower here than with taking down General McChrystal. Also, a little bit reminds me a little bit maybe of what happened in Game Change where Harry Reid thought he was not on the record. So, you know, politicians ought to always assume that reporters will report what they say and that they're not your friends and that it's always on the record. I mean, that's one lesson. I do think that Coppins is aided a little bit by the fact that people don't like Donald Trump. And so they're going to say, yeah, well, he did, you know, Trump had it coming. So in other words, it may not hurt BuzzFeed's access. It may not hurt Coppins' ability to do these things because people may just say, Donald Trump had it coming. He's a bad guy. He was showing off. And so I think that may be part of the calculus here. Now, the interesting thing is it took BuzzFeed like 3 or 4 weeks to get around to publishing the story. And they only did it, as far as I can tell, after they reimbursed Trump. So they have an ethics policy about reimbursing, you know, that they can't sort of take gifts. And so Coppins, when they were at Mar-a-Lago, Coppins says, you know, I can't stay here for free. And Trump's like, oh, okay. Then it's going to be $100,000 for the plane down here, you know, for the private plane trip. Well, so what happened though is I guess Trump just charged them for a first class ticket. So it was like $850. And it is interesting that BuzzFeed essentially got the invoice and paid it before they wrote this story. I think, you know, someone will let me know if I got my timeline wrong, but I'm wondering why it took so long to write this story. There's speculation that Ben Smith, not McKay Coppins, the Trump people are pushing the notion that it was Ben Smith who turned this into a hit piece. And that's why it took so long, that it wasn't Coppins who wrote it. So I don't know if this means anything. It's just, it's a fun story. And there's a lot of gossip and a lot of snark associated with it.
I don't really understand what, I mean, I haven't read the piece from end to end. I kind of skimmed it a bit. I know it sort of tries to sort of tease out why does Trump keep pretending he's running for president or running for anything when he never does. He's doing it for 25 years. But I guess the question in my mind is, does this, I don't think anyone's going to side with Trump over BuzzFeed on this because Trump's credibility is shot. I don't think anyone sort of, anything in that article that doesn't seem implausible as far as what Trump and others would say.
Let me just say that real quick, Bill. I will just real quick say, everything McKay Coppins wrote seems, it rings true. I mean, it's plausible. And the stuff that Breitbart wrote about Coppins does not sound accurate. It does not ring true for what that's worth.
But does this change the calculus, maybe not for whether it's for about McCoppins specifically or just for Portage in general, you have your candidate for high office and you're hustling for press attention. There's definitely a premium put on access to get placement, to get attention to what you're doing. But access comes with risk as far as what you, because you don't control what's going to be reported at the end. There is this kind of, you know, push-pull. And obviously, you know, some candidates go John McCain Straight Talk Express and just let him on the bus and, you know, let it all fly. And some folks are very tight-lipped. And, you know, the Bush team in 2004 was you know, kind of a lockdown environment. You'll say the Obama campaign team was pretty tight on press access in 2012. And that worked for them. But, of course, these are folks who were going to get coverage anyway. They weren't, you know, second-tier candidates scrapping for every bit of media they could get their hands on. But if you're going to do the access route, logic would say, you know, dress up, you know, behave nicely. Don't do dumb things with the reporter in the room. You shouldn't do dumb things with reporters not in the room because you never know what someone's going to say. You would think people would learn this lesson by now.
Bill, you got to understand, though, there's a manipulation going on, right? So when I was with John McCain on the Straight Talk Express, and he called us all, as he would always call reporters and journalists, you know, idiots or... it was sort of an endearing thing, a bunch of jerks, you know.
Right.
Trump, when you're with Trump and he's this larger than life billionaire, and he's like, "Oh, there's a lot of good looking women down here." In a way, there's this sort of ironic thing that happens is because he is saying something that you know he shouldn't say, and he knows he shouldn't say it, you're now sort of in on it with him, and you're sort of implicated now. And I think that it's a form of manipulation that he's treating you like one of the guys. He's treating you as if he can trust you. Therefore, you feel like you have to be his guy. You want to impress the Donald. You want to be his friend, and you want to have more interviews with him. And I think it can be very seductive. Now, obviously, Buzz, you know, McKay Coppins was not seduced by that. But he probably acted as if he was, that's the question. It's like, do you think that Coppins actually ever, like, said, hey, this is going to be a really bad piece, you're not going to like it? He sort of had to probably play along with it. And that takes a certain type of person with a certain type of stomach who can do that, and a certain killer instinct as a journalist that I think he has now displayed that he has the ability to do it. There's a great quote from this famous California politician named Big Daddy Jess Unruh, who said, as a politician, he said, if you can't, I'm going to clean it up here, but he said, if you can't take their money, sleep with their women, drink their booze, and then still vote against them the next day, then you're in the wrong business. and his point was, like, you can hang out with lobbyists and, you know, take everything from them, and then still vote against them. And I think maybe this is the journalistic the journalistic version. I'm not saying that Coppins did anything, partook in any of the drinking or the women, because I don't think he did, despite the allegations, or the implications coming, from Trump now retroactively. But I do think that there is a certain thing where, a lot of people would have been seduced by Trump, and they would have been, wow, he knows who I am. He's flattering me. He's saying all these great things about me. He's putting me up at this awesome hotel. There's no way I can go write a negative piece, you know, betraying all the things that Donald said to me. Coppins did that. And that, I don't know if that makes him a horrible person or one hell of a good reporter, but he did.
To the point about the allegations against Coppins that the Trump people, you know, fed to Breitbart, what does this mean about Breitbart? Is this good for Breitbart to be the recipient of, you know, Trump-fed smears? I mean, obviously, its audience is not, you know, a politically heterodox audience. It's a conservative audience, and Trump is basically a conservative figure. Do you think that conservatives are going to respect Breitbart for effectively taking Trump's side here? Or does this besmirch what they're trying to do, since they're seen as, you know, being Trump's handmaiden?
I think it hurts him, honestly. You know, there are a couple of my former colleagues are over there. And one of them is a guy named Jonathan Strong, who is a fabulous journalist. I worked with him at the Daily Caller. He is a great reporter.
I just want to add that he was doing stuff for the National Review side by side with Robert Costa during a lot of debt limit stuff. I mean,
before that he was at Roll Call.
I mean, he functioned as a straight reporter. I mean, he was not functioning as an ideologue in that role. And I was actually surprised they went to Breitbart, because they've been, you know, not so journalistically stringent over their years. But I took
John is a great reporter who could be at the New York Times or the Washington Post or Politico. I mean, I would hire him in a heartbeat. So when they hired him, I thought maybe they were going to rebrand and sort of try to fill the gap, you know, since he and Costa had both left National Review. And I think this sort of thing sets that, if there was an effort to do that, I think this sets that effort back.
Well, the shift gears to self-promotion. I had a piece up at the Week this week, talking about what struck me. I there was a Marist poll that came out last week that Hillary, you know, lapping the field, beating every Republican. The closest was Paul Ryan at 8 points. Most of the other field was double digits. And she was beating Chris Christie by 21 points. And what particularly struck me was that in the previous Maris poll in January, it had people mostly believing Chris Christie, saying Chris Christie is mostly truthful in his response to the Bridgegate scandal. And now that those numbers flipped, and now they seem as mostly untruthful. And what I took from that was, so here you have this you know, 4 week period or so since mid January, where MSNBC has been giving Christie the treatment, prioritizing the scandal, you know, magnifying every possible angle, interviewing all sorts of New Jersey legislative investigators and whatnot. At the same time, Fox has been taking it to Hillary on Benghazi. I mean, they've not dropped the Benghazi beat at all. They've been launching new allegations. There was a new House Republican report on Benghazi they gave a lot of play to, where the New York Times at the end of December wrote a piece that debunked a lot of conservative myths about Benghazi. Fox went nuts and attacked the New York Times, said during it, there being, you know, Hillary's PR arm. But all that Fox News fury hasn't dented Hillary at all. And despite the fact that Fox has a bigger audience and has been in this, you know, sort of, you know, muckraking game for a lot longer, MSNBC is kind of the new kid on the block. They haven't really done a lot of scandal coverage. It hasn't really been their thing. This is kind of a new phase of their lean forward strategy, and they're drawing blood. So my piece of the week was, you know, why is NBC's scandal coverage better than Fox's? Why are they more influential than Fox's? This is really not talking about, you know, the specifics of the reporting, but just in terms of basic influence, MSNBC is influencing Christie more than Fox is influencing Hillary, or people's perceptions of the two, despite the discrepancy in audience size. And I just think this is evidence that Fox, their credibility has been so shot because they've chased down so many rabbit holes. They don't budge when exculpatory evidence comes to light. They stick with their pre-cooked narrative over and over again. And so even if their audience is bigger, it's contained. It's a true echo chamber that doesn't get out beyond that. And it used to, and I feel like they used to be able to catapult stuff into the mainstream media a lot more. Now they're not able to do that as easily. And MSNBC has, but even though there's some people that's kind of scoff at MSNBC, you know, Bill Maher just came out and said, it's over between us. You're turning into Fox because you're so obsessed with Bridgegate. I know anecdotally, I know some people are like, yo, I've had enough. I've heard it. You know, I think some people feel like you've already killed this guy. What else is there left to say?
Well, I'm in the Bill Maher category. I think
but nevertheless, they still are. They say what they have done has driven the story in a way that Fox was not able to drive the Benghazi story.
Bill, I think you're confusing, you know, correlation with causation. I mean, there was the 1 week, obviously, when the mayor came out on Up with Kornacki and did drive the narrative there. But aside from that, I just think they're beating a dead horse. I mean, the fact that Christie is being hurt, I don't know that you can attribute that to MSNBC, aside from that one obvious instance.
Well, let's think of a world where MSNBC did not exist. I mean, it's pure hypothetical. Obviously, you could spin out different scenarios with that hypothesis. But when Christie gave his initial press conference, there was a lot of punditry that, wow, that was a good press conference. He stuck it out. He answered every question. He took care of business. He fired the people that needed to be fired. You know, there's no way he'd be so crazy to do that himself. So the early poll numbers suggested that was true. You know, the January poll numbers, he was holding steady. And so a lot of press was acting like, well, I guess this is pretty much over. And MSNBC was kind of alone, sort of nationally. I obviously, there's the Jersey reporters too, so you got to factor that in. But the MSNBC were like, no, this is not over. There's plenty of unanswered questions here. We're going to keep at this. And I think as part of that, you know, Kornacki gets the scoop. Kornacki gets the Hurricane Sandy scoop from the Hoboken mayor that gives the story a second wind and really expands, you know, the scope of questions. Well, what was really underlying, if there's a sort of larger corrupt culture, what was the real reason why the bridge closures happened in the first place? Is it about these issues about controversial developments, which they've been speculating about over the past few weeks? I think it's possible that this could have just died down. I mean, the Jersey investigators at the legislative level might have kept doing their work, but there wouldn't be this drip, drip, drip.
But the Hoboken mayor story
that weighs Christie down.
But two things. I mean, one, the Hoboken mayor story is like a month old now, and yet Chris Matthews will, apropos of nothing, be talking about the Bridgegate scandal, the Bridgegazi scandal, or whatever you want to call it tonight. And number two, I think it's been pretty well illustrated that she didn't get less than her fair share for Hoboken from the Hurricane Sandy funds. I mean, there have been a lot of pretty reputable people and outlets who have poked holes in that story. So it may be bogus to begin with, and even if it was, this is a long time, we're a long ways removed. My problem with what Fox and MSNBC are both doing is that it doesn't reflect any reality in terms of what's driving a news cycle. I mean, by all accounts, everybody today should be talking, I would think, about the Ukraine, about Venezuela, about McKay Coppins and Trump, about the CBO report and minimum wage. I mean, these are relevant stories. Everybody I follow on Twitter, people who are, you know, political reporters and analysts and commentators, these are the stories that everybody else in the real world are focused on today. So it seems to be a non sequitur when I turn on Chris Matthews tonight and he's harping on a scandal, a months old scandal in New Jersey. And I can say the same thing about when I turned on Fox News last night and they were talking about Kathleen Sebelius and Obamacare. I mean, I'm not to say that these aren't important issues, but they in no way reflect the real world of what people are talking about today. And it's as if they've become totally disconnected from covering the news or the news cycle and are much more interested in driving their own agenda, which is fine. Sometimes you can force stories into the mainstream by focusing on them. But, I mean, I don't know how they can do, like, how can Chris Matthews do yet another story on the Chris? I don't know how they have like the patience and the, I would have, if I were a host of a show, I would have a very difficult time justifying doing yet another segment on Bridgegate today, unless there's new information. And yet they will do it every day in and day out, I guess until they decide not to.
Well, I haven't watched MSNBC in the past 24 hours. I don't know what percentage they gave to Ukraine or to the CBO report. I would imagine some, but I don't have numbers for you. I don't think they've gone literally wall to wall on Christie. But to your main point, they obviously have prioritized the story in a way that no other national news outlet has. The same way Fox has prioritized other stories that they think their audience, you know, wants to see. I think that I do think that I think it's new for MSNBC to do it in this way. I don't think they are the first to do this. I mean, look, Lou Dobbs used to do immigration, immigration, immigration every single day,
and that was ridiculous then. That was horrible then, and it's horrible now. And look, when the Christie scandal broke, they did great reporting on it. Don't get me wrong; I think that it deserved to be covered and obsessed on, but this is ridiculous.
Well, my question here, I mean, we can talk about, you know, what's sort of good for media or bad for media as far as, you know, quality is concerned. You know, my focus on this one piece was not talking about that. We're talking about who is doing it better, who's having the better time, the more influence in pursuing this strategy. I think both networks are going to do what they think is good for their bottom line. They're primarily businesses. They're trying to appeal to their audiences. I'm sure if they get to a point where MSNBC feels like they're losing audience because people are turning off Christie coverage, they're going to scale back their Christie coverage. I don't think they are I don't think they are partisans in that respect. And I talk about it in my piece, you know, they went hard on Anthony Weiner in 2011 and 2013, you know, because they thought it was a good story.
Well, let me ask you, Bill, because I disagree with you. I think it's in both cases, they're probably undermining their brands and not advancing the story. And I think you're confusing correlation with causation. But what, let's just assume you're right. What is MSNBC doing better? Like, what are they doing differently that is leading them to a better result?
Well, what I think they're doing better is, one, they don't chase down every rabbit hole. You know, they're not in the scandal business no matter what. I mean, I think Fox, it has, and this is true for a lot of conservative media, you know, it's Salinger and it's Fast and Furious and it's IRS. You know, it's one after another. And even when these stories don't pan out, they still stick to it as if they are panning out. You know, I think that undermines credibility. I think MSNBC doesn't do that. And I think MSNBC is willing, when there is a Democratic scandal they think is legit, they do take that on also. They don't, they're not partisan about who they go after. But at the same time, they obviously have a liberal audience, and a liberal audience that has more interest in the Christie scandal than a Fox audience does. And they're trying to give their audience what they want. But I think they do it in a way that is not, I think they separate the fact from the speculation. They speculate. They punditize, no doubt. You know, they throw ideas out there that aren't necessarily backed up yet, but I think they're clear when they're doing that. They don't pretend that they know more than they do. And they do actual reporting. They get some actual scoops. You know, so they directly drive the coverage also. They're not just sitting back and just blathering. So I think all those things combined are making their coverage more influential than Fox's coverage has been.
Well, it is funny. I mean, you know, if you landed here from another planet and just turned on MSNBC, you would think that what's happening in New Jersey is the most important story and what everyone's talking about. And nobody's talking about it right now. You and I know that. And I say the same thing about Fox. And so, you know, it is weird that, you know, that they've essentially staked out these stories. You're arguing that this is like a free market and that this is a smart business decision. I suppose you're right, but
I feel like the era of news editors, I mean, this is what newspapers do. They sit back and say, okay, we are going to tell the consumer what is the news and what isn't the news. We're deciding what's news. We're telling you what's more important. And you are trusting us to make those judgments for you. And I like that model, you know, on a meritorious basis. I'm not trying to be anti-elitist here. I feel like that model has not been terribly profitable. And the outlets that are saying, like, we're going to give the people what they want and find the niches that want certain things, those folks are doing better.
Yeah. So a month's old scandal with no new developments, I suppose Trump's revolution.
I'm not saying one is more important than the other, but I think the creative part of it is finding a way to find the new developments and to advance the story, even when the other reporters aren't finding that. I mean, I think if you're just doing the same punditry over and over again, you know, even your most hardcore fans are going to tune out. I think MSNBC has found this. I mean, this is Lou Dobbs' challenge. How do you talk immigration every single day, all the time? He found a way. I mean, I don't necessarily have the stamina to pound on one subject over and over again, but he did, and he had good ratings, you know, from a slice of the public.
Yeah.
And I found what he was doing to be abhorrent and factually flawed in many, many instances. But as a business model, it worked for him for a long time.
Hey, Bill. Have you been watching House of Cards?
I've not been watching House of Cards. I don't watch a lot of political fiction.
Yeah.
I have enough political nonfiction in my day.
But
is there something you can say about it that doesn't have spoilers?
I'll just say this to make it relevant to our discussion. Frank Underwood watches Morning Joe at night. He tapes it. and Ashley Banfield, I think that's her name, from CNN, is a good actress, but I think a much tougher interviewer in the fictional world than anybody would be in the real world. But you should watch it, Bill. It's addictive, man. You start watching, I'm telling you what, you get into it. It's one of those things that if you get into it and you're there, you're not turning it off. It'll totally, now, suck you in.
What was the other political show that had? Was it Alpha House? Was the other one that was an online political show?
I don't know. I never even watched West Wing. But you know, it's hit or miss. But if I get, like, for me, it's like if I get into something, then I'm into it. You know,
right?
Like, I didn't watch Friday Night Lights while it was on, but then I totally got hooked on it when it was on Netflix. I think Netflix is like the that's what'll get me hooked if it's on there, because then I have the Apple TV. I can just project it up on my big TV and all that. You want to talk minimum wage, or you want to bail? How we doing?
We do minimum wage. I know it's a subject of interest to you, interest to me. It's a real story, right? It's not one of these trumped up stories from the cable networks.
They should devote more time to this. Yeah.
Well, now, I actually had written previously that I thought minimum wage would pass the Republican House, because historically, every president since it was installed in 38 has raised the minimum wage, Republican or Democrat, with the exception of Reagan. He's the only exception. And this has been true even when there are Republican Congresses and Democratic presidents who don't like each other. Truman got very little through Congress in his day. It was a democratically controlled Congress, but conservatives had the majority and stymied him on most things, but not minimum wage. Clinton in 96, Gingrich was not the friendliest of speakers to Clinton, but he had a number of vulnerable Republicans who were begging Gingrich to let a vote occur, and Gingrich relented. And Bob Dole was fighting Clinton, but then he stepped down to focus on this presidential run, and Trent Lott let a minimum wage vote go through, and it passed. So I felt that history would repeat. It's always a very popular issue. It doesn't cost the Treasury money, and Republicans will usually stand down so long as it's paired with some other kind of, you know, goodies for small business, so they can say it was a balanced bill. Negative CBO report, which makes a projection. I feel there are a couple. If I may slant the introduction of this whole topic, the headline is CBO says minimum wage will lose jobs, or minimum wage will lose 500,000 jobs. And that's not quite what it's saying. It's saying, one, it gave two different sets of projections for the $10.10 proposal and a different set for the $9 proposal. And two, it's talking about a range of possibilities based on, you know, all sorts of different studies on the subject. And it's not saying that 500,000 people are going to get fired. It's saying there'll be 500,000 jobs fewer than there might otherwise been for a variety of reasons. In most cases, not because someone got fired, but because someone leaves a job and they don't get replaced or something like that. So I guess my question is the headline so damaging that any explanation can't save it at this point? Republicans have their excuse to not act on it. Or is it still, it's a popular subject in general that, you know, most people don't read CBO reports, and you can look at the $9 an hour numbers, which are far more tame. There's a range from, you know, a slight job loss to a slight job increase. You know, it's effectively saying not much impact on the job market at all. It still would be a pretty decent jump from $7.25 to go to $9. and you can still pair it with other kinds of goodies for small business. So is there still a room for compromise here, or is just the impact of the headline too much for Democrats to overcome and gives an easy out for Republicans to bag the whole thing?
So, I think that, you know, in the future, as it has been in the past, raising the minimum wage will remain popular because it just sounds like a compassionate thing to do, even if it costs jobs. It sounds good. I do think this kills it in the short term. But I have a couple points that I want to make about it. Number one, I want to make the point that when conservatives oppose things like raising the minimum wage, it is not because they are horrible, mean people. It is because they believe, you know, and economists are divided on this, but we believe that raising the minimum wage will mean that fewer people get hired. You're raising the cost of hiring somebody, which will drive, you know, which means fewer people will be hired. So, in other words, if the Democrats have their way, there will be more people who are doing better and more people who have nothing. So we would argue that this will actually increase the unemployment rate and it will actually sort of grow income inequality in a sense. It's instead of spreading the wealth around, you either have no job, or a good job. Whereas maybe you would argue it's better to have two people making $7 an hour than one person making 14 an hour and one person making zero an hour. Agree with that or not? I just want to make the point that I think conservatives are oftentimes criticized. If you come out against the minimum wage hike, you're considered evil, mean. This is a philosophical difference. And I think that it's important to note, in this case, the CBO actually confirms the position. But whether you agree with the CBO report or not, I do want to stress the point that I think, you know, when conservatives, that they have obviously the best of intentions here. And I think a lot of times their motives are impugned.
Now, if you are a conservative with good intentions on this subject, you simply want there to be, people with good jobs and good wages and putting roofs over their heads for people who work hard and play by the rules, yada, yada, yada. You have folks on the left saying that CBO was basing stuff on conservative assumptions. As you said, there still is a wide range of debate amongst economists. It's not settled one way or the other what the impact on jobs is for minimum wage increases, and it depends, of course, how much of an increase you're even talking about. So we shouldn't treat the CBO report as being – I mean, they're not even saying – this is precisely true, and this is sure to happen, and there's no other scenario plausible. There's still a range of possibilities you can't, and a range of other factors are involved that can't be captured in one study. And even in this report, say, look, you're still going to have a rise in income. You're still going to have millions and millions of people with higher incomes because of this, and not just at the minimum wage level, but in some of the notches above that. You could still make the argument that it is a net positive, even if there are some, losers in the process. Couldn't you come, if you're coming at this with good intentions and good faith, say, okay, if you just did minimum wage, you got a bunch of winners and some losers. Can we pair this with something else to make sure we don't have those losers? I mean, it doesn't have to be a standalone bill. I mean, they've paired this in the past with small business tax cuts, for example. That might be harder today because of the budget caps that they're working under. But couldn't we think of something? or try to find something to say, okay, if you're going to do this to help, you know, people in this camp, let's do something else to help people in the other camp. I mean, that shouldn't be that hard to solve, right?
Well, I think, first of all, I mean, I guess a few things. Well, let me start. I do want to answer your question, but let me start with giving, I think, a fair take on the different points of view. So conservatives would argue that if you raise the price of a job, you will have fewer jobs. It's supply and demand. And not only that, but you would really incentivize automation. So for example, you know, I'm a small business owner and I own a little fast food restaurant and I have, you know, maybe two people working at the lunch shift. Maybe I just you know, put out a couple thousand dollars and get one of those self-serve, you know, Coke and Diet Coke refill machines, and only have one guy working now, right? Because the cost of that machine, I have to, you know, dole out a few thousand bucks to put it, but I don't, you know, no one's going to tell me I have to raise the minimum wage for that machine once I make the investment. So, I mean, conservatives would argue that businesses are in the business to make money, and rather than hiring two people, there'll be a point of diminishing returns where they'll decide, let's do something else. We can only afford to have one guy. Let's automate, you know, use technology or whatever. Now, the liberals are, you know, the Obama administration, Gene Sperling, whomever, they actually have a tougher sell in this case. Usually it's conservatives who are worrying about, like, unintended consequences and trying to explain dynamic scoring. In this case, I think the liberals actually, you know, once you get past the sort of knee-jerk reaction that raising minimum wage is good, they actually have a tougher argument to make. They're really arguing that there should be dynamic scoring. And so they're going to basically say that, like, okay, if you raise the minimum wage, there's a lot of magical things that are going to happen that the CBO may not be capturing, right? So they're going to say, okay, well, if you raise minimum wage, then workers are going to be more productive and they're going to have higher morale. So they're going to do a better job, which means the business is going to grow. You're going to have more customers because the people taking care of them, serving them, are happier. That you're going to reduce employee turnover, which will improve profits. I mean, so there are all these, like, factors out there that you can't really quantify that are going to sort of magically happen. So, I mean, I do think it's important to sort of note that both sides have sort of assumptions about what is going to happen if you raise minimum wage. Having said that, you know, I think, well, I do want to answer your question, and I've sort of jabbered on specifically, Bill, refresh my memory, what?
Well, couldn't you pair this with something? I mean, even if, if we're taking the CBO report in full, it is saying that there, I think it's like 16 million people would have higher income. It's not like nobody wins. So if you have 60 million people are going to be helped by it, but 500,000 people, it's not even quite saying that, but let's just, for simplicity's sake, let's just say it. So you got 60 million people do better, 500,000 do worse. Can't we pair it with something so those 500,000 people don't get the short stick? I mean, it doesn't have to be a standalone bill at the end of the day. If we're trying to help people, if we're trying to approach them in good faith, why can't we have a hybrid policy?
So I would say that in a time when unemployment and poverty are problems, it would be insane to do something to increase unemployment. Having said that, I think that rather than a hybrid approach, you could have alternative approaches. So, for example, Michael Strain, who's an economist at AEI, was recently on my podcast. He actually advocates lowering minimum wage, but extending unemployment benefits, which is sort of an unorthodox viewpoint. He also advocates earned income, you know, expanding earned income tax credits. So I think in the sense that that conservatives, you know, can be compassionate during this downtime and have alternative ways of helping people who are struggling in this economy, I absolutely think it's possible. In terms of having a hybrid approach that pairs raising the minimum wage with some sort of other thing to offset that or to fix the problems that it would create, I think that would be counterproductive. I hope that answers the question.
It doesn't answer the question satisfactorily to me, but I just think that I take your point that there are conservatives who have a belief system that's not predicated on just screwing people, that they actually have a different belief in what's going to make the economy grow and what's going to create good jobs and whatnot. I just think that obviously there's always going to be people with different belief systems on that score. And in the past, there's been a meeting halfway. Okay, you think minimum wage raises incomes. These folks think minimum wage hurts small businesses. let's raise the minimum wage and give other help to small businesses and mitigate those effects. And I think that has generally worked well over time, that we haven't, we have raised the minimum wage before. We have a minimum wage. It's not like no one's proposing to abolish it right now, or no one's proposing it seriously. We have paired that and said, okay, you need to have a, there is a floor. If we had full employment at $2 an hour, that would not be good. People would not be living well in that scenario. So we have a floor. We do other help for small business to make sure that it doesn't lead to unnecessary job loss. And I think we could, I think it's plausible one could do that again. I'd like to see Michael Strain's views scored by the CBO and see how that would look. And so we'd have some apples apples comparisons here. But even still, I just feel like there should be a way to take the best from column A and the best from column B.
Yes, at the very least, Bill, the point I do want to make and just reiterate again is that a lot of times I think conservatives are accused of being, you know, mean-spirited, cold-hearted, not caring about the poor. And the truth is that this is a prime example of how there are two competing worldviews and visions for how best to help people and grow the economy and benefit the most Americans. And I think it's unfortunate that, you know, one side and both sides do this on different issues, but I think this is a prime example of how it's not about being mean or not caring. It's about a difference of opinion. In this case, backed up by the CBO. But I would still have the same view. If the CBO had scored differently, it wouldn't have changed my mind. And I assume it's not going to change yours. But I do think it's indicative of how, you know, both sides can care and want to help people and have very different conclusions regarding how best to do that. So I see this as
I think Republicans have a
positive uniting story.
I think Republicans have a different problem with the unemployment insurance issue because they have been, or some have been saying, well, I would be for it. You know, I don't want to hurt the unemployed. I do think they should deserve extended benefits, but I don't want it to cost us money. Let's find an offset for it. And Harry Reid had proposed at one point, okay, let's tack a year on to sequestration. And people said, no, that's backdoor spending cuts down the road that won't stick, and that doesn't work for me. And all of a sudden, just this past week, Republicans embraced that exact offset to scrap these cuts in military pensions that were just agreed upon a month ago. So it sort of exposes that, you know, if it really wasn't about the offset, it was about the issue. You've seen Politico today, you still see some Republicans, Dan Coats, Rob Portman, Susan Collins, Mark Kirk, you know, they still kind of want to do a deal, it seems. They just want to be able to say we reformed the UI program in some way, and Democrats don't like the reforms they're proposing so far because they think they would hurt the program. But I think it did expose, at minimum, that it really wasn't about the offset for a lot of people, because obviously they found the offset appropriate for a different...
Well, it may not be about the offset, but it could still be a noble... I mean, conservatives could still have a very legitimate point of view where they believe that expanding unemployment benefits will actually hurt people, will get them, you know, essentially in a cycle of dependency, will cause them to turn down other opportunities that may not pay them as much as they are looking for. So they may or may not be right about that, but the question, their motives, which is often done in politics.
I think the motives would be less in question if they were embracing some package of ideas as a party. Say, here is our plan to increase jobs and give relief to those looking for work. Right now, it's been generally a lot of talking points. I mean, you legitimately bring up the AEI report from Michael Strain, which I think there are a number of folks on the left that say, you know, we don't agree with all this, but there's some good ideas in here. This is not an insincere package, but you haven't seen the Republican Party pick that up and take parts of it and say, okay, this is our plan now. There's only been obstruction and nothing proactive so far.
All right. Gotta go, Bill. Thanks. See ya.
Okay. Bye. Next week. Bye-bye.